I'm here to talk to you about this wonderful topic of not holding to fixed views. And Diane, you might correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the first fetters, or one of the first things that kind of falls away in terms of liberation is an identity view, right? So it's a type of view, and it's a view about our identity. So views are really kind of really where, you know, that's kind of the gist of practice, is often we hold certain views about how things should be. How many of you came here tonight with an idea that meditation should be quiet and peaceful and not interrupted by leaf blowers and other kinds of things? So that's important information to know, right? Because if this was the yogi work day and there was meditation going on in here and somebody was outside raking or blowing leaves, perhaps holding that view tightly of meditation should be quiet and uninterrupted by all kinds of other sounds, that might not be a very useful view to hold. Or rather, that might create a lot of suffering in your mind about how it should be, right? So this is what I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk a little bit about, there's a phenomenon that's been named as, maybe you've heard the term filter bubble or echo chamber. Anybody unfamiliar with those terms? Okay. So sometimes we live in what might be called a bubble, in which, you know, we have a nice particular area that makes us nice and comfortable. You know, we come to places like this where there's all these people of like minds, and wow, you know, it just seems like we're all together, all on the same thing, and we're kind of protected. And then we get jarred by maybe news on TV, or jarred by news outside of our little bubble. And a lot of times we can stay in those bubbles and filter everything out that doesn't fit. I just want to stay here in this bubble. And these bubbles actually exist in the world if you use the internet. So if you use Google, how many of you use Google or some other search engine, right? Did you know that Google kind of keeps track of what it is that you search for? And it creates kind of a different view. So when you do a search for a term, it will show you the things that it thinks that you like, or the things that kind of match your personality or match the things that you search for. And one really good way to find that out is go somewhere where there's a computer in which you're not logged onto it and you're somehow anonymous, and put the same search term in. And you'll find that it brings up a whole different list. You know, and it's quite surprising, because you might do that search on your computer and you go, wow, when I did that search on my computer, that one thing that I was looking for came up as number 3 or number 4. And then you're at somebody else's house, they're logged in on their thing, and you go, hey, let's Google this. And you Google that and you go, yeah, I know that it came up as the 3rd or 4th thing. And you go, wait, it's not there. Why is it not there? Because you're using a different set of criteria that Google is feeding to you, or Facebook also feeds you things that it says, oh, you've liked all these things, and you click on all these things, so that it keeps track of what you do, and then it serves up to you the things that kind of help keep you in that same bubble. It gives you the things that it thinks are what you like. And that could be good news, but it could also be bad news, because you get a very distorted view of what the world is like. So this is something where technology is really keeping track of our likes and dislikes and dishes up accordingly. And you might think about in your own life how your likes and dislikes maybe pull you around in particular ways. And this is what the Buddha talks about in terms of the vedana, or feeling tone, of pleasant and unpleasant. You know, that we are often the slaves of pleasant sensations and unpleasant sensations. You know, how many of you, during the meditation, experienced some quality of unpleasant at some point tonight? And how many of you had an imperative thought that said, I have to do something about this unpleasant sensation? Or why is this unpleasant sensation arising? Or maybe there was a pleasant sensation. Maybe, wow, you know, the meditation got really nice, you felt very calm. And then something popped into your mind that disturbed it. And you were like, oh, but I want that back. I want that calm back. I want that peace back. I want to not be assaulted by my thoughts or by my emotions or whatever is going on. So here is this field in which we can start to look at likes and dislikes and how those manifest in our lives. So in the Samyutta Nikaya, there's a verse or a couple of verses that I wanted to read to you. So the Buddha is talking to his monks and nuns and the practitioners that are there. So you can imagine that monks means whoever is there that's practicing together. Monks, it is by way of elements that beings come together and unite. Those lacking faith come together and unite with those lacking faith. The shameless with the shameless. Those unafraid of wrongdoing with those unafraid of wrongdoing. The unlearned with the unlearned. The lazy with the lazy, the muddle-minded with the muddle-minded, the unwise with the unwise. In the past it was so, in the future it will be so, and now too, at present, it is so. Monks, it is by way of elements that beings come together and unite. Those having faith come together and unite with those having faith. Those having a sense of shame with those having a sense of shame. Those afraid of wrongdoing with those afraid of wrongdoing. The learned with the learned. The energetic with the energetic. The mindful with the mindful. The wise with the wise. In the past it was so, in the future it will be so, and now too, at present, it is so. Oh, that's kind of interesting. I think it's provocative that the Buddha 2,500, 2,600 years ago was talking about how we tend to group together with like views. There's nothing specifically wrong with that, but to recognize that, you know, we tend to cluster together in particular ways. So all of us are here tonight. Why? Because we have some particular views in common. Maybe we're all mindful and all the mindful people are here tonight. But here's what happens, here's what the Buddha says can happen when we don't examine our predilections. He says, now, how would one, led on by desire, entrenched in his likes, forming his own conclusions, overcome his own views? He'd dispute in line with the way that he knows. So that's out of the Atthakavagga. So how do we know when our likes and our views and our conclusions maybe blind us? How do we know that we don't start disputing in line with what we know and not see a larger picture? It's a little bit more out of the Atthakavagga. Dependent upon what is seen, heard, cognized, or upon moral conduct and religious practices, a person shows contempt for others. Abiding by his fixed opinions and pleased with himself, he says, my opponent's a fool. He's no expert. Upon whatever basis she regards her opponent a fool is the same upon which she regards herself an expert. To the extent to which she rates herself an expert, she despises anyone else who makes the same claim. Do you know anybody that fits that description? You know, Suzuki Roshi used to say that, you know, a beginner's mind, or the difference between beginner's mind and expert mind, is that the expert mind thinks that they know the right thing. And the beginner's mind doesn't hold any particular idea in mind. And so the expert's view is limited, and you might consider that. You know, when we think that we know the answer, then our mind is not open to seeing other solutions. But if we hold a beginner's mind of, I'm not sure, I don't know, now we can actually open to the possibility that there might be other solutions or other ways of seeing. So to pay attention to how perhaps we may even have a confirmation bias of looking for the validation of what we believe rather than seeing a wider picture, seeing the whole picture, and not just the slice that we want to see. And further, one more verse. A person who associates oneself with certain views, considering them as best and making them supreme in the world, says, because of that, that all other views are inferior. Therefore, one is not free from contention with others in what is seen, heard, cognized, and in ritual observances performed. One sees a profit for oneself. Just by laying hold of that view, one regards every other view as worthless. So that's kind of provocative, kind of interesting. Now sometimes we may even think, oh, I've got the right view. Everybody else is wrong. And how many times do we fall for that? How many times do we actually believe that? In maybe very simple, unassuming ways. not the large picture views, but even just our small daily views. So a couple months ago, I came across a podcast on a program on NPR called Invisibilia. Does anybody know about that? Yeah. So this one podcast episode was called The Culture Inside. And you might, if you're intrigued about it, I encourage you to listen to it, because it's just amazing. It's just amazing. One of the pieces in that podcast was about a newscaster in the Bay Area by the name of Frank Somerville, and some of you may know who he is. He told a story of a situation in which he was coming back to work from the gym, and this was in Oakland. And he's a white person, white man. And he happened to see this woman who was white sitting at the bus stop. And it was kind of late. So he thought, she's by herself, and maybe I should just kind of keep an eye on her. And so out of his eye, he sees this man coming towards her, and it's a black man. And so, you know, the radar picks up, and he's like, oh, maybe this is dangerous. Maybe something's going to happen. So he's really watching this black guy as he starts to approach this woman. And he's kind of wearing, you know, a hoodie and whatnot. And then he sees this little movement in the background, and there's this little child, and this child is running after his father, who's the black man. And suddenly, his whole idea of what that scenario is shifted. And the thing that was really poignant for him, or that was really shocking for him, was he's the father of a black daughter he adopted. And he had told her stories about, well, you know, you have to realize that white people may have certain ideas about you because of the color of your skin. And he thought he was being quite inclusive and race aware and just being the person that's not going to be racist or discriminatory or have these views. And he was just shocked by that. In fact, he was so ashamed by that, that he was literally tearful about sharing that experience. Because here he thought, oh my gosh, this is something that I told my daughter that she would experience, and I didn't think I would be the person to make that kind of a judgment about someone. So it goes to show that sometimes we can even have intentions to be kind, intentions to be accepting, intentions to not be biased, and yet we can be blindsided by implicit biases that we may not see, that we may not be aware of, that we may actually be blind to. And, you know, we make associations that come from the moment that we're born, even moments before we're born. So there are studies that were done with women who were pregnant in France, who were asked to eat certain kinds of food while they were pregnant. And one of the foods was anise, which is a common flavoring, but it's got a very strong licorice flavor. And so one group of women that were asked to eat anise while they were pregnant did that, and another group of women were not asked to do that. And then when they were nursing their babies, after their babies were born and they were nursing their babies, they would slip in a little bit of anise into a formula, and they would feed the babies the formula. And lo and behold, the babies whose mothers ate anise while they were pregnant liked the formula with the anise in it. And the babies whose mothers didn't eat anise, you know, because of the strong flavor, didn't like it. So here we have preference already happening before we're even born, just in the womb. So it's to recognize that we may have different biases that occur just because of our culture, our environment, our parents, our friends as we're growing up. All of these influence certain associations. And it's not to say that they're bad, but if we're not aware, then we can't do anything about them. And that's the piece that's of importance. That's where our practice comes in, is to actually pay attention to, oh, what am I taking for granted? Or what am I taking as implicitly true that might not be? So I want to ask you to do an experiment with me. Take your hands and lace them together. And just notice how that feels. And now what I'd like you to do is take your hands apart. And now lace them the other way. So intentionally lace them with the other thumb on top. And notice how that is. I bet there's some like, ooh, this is weird, or this is hard, or this doesn't feel right. Okay? Now the only reason it doesn't feel right is because we have habitually laced our hands in one direction through our lives. And that's the only reason that it feels odd. And so if we were to start lacing our hands the other way, that might actually start to feel comfortable over time, where it might not feel so weird. But here's an example in which there's an perhaps unexamined way that we do certain things that we think this is the right way to do it and has never been explored. So maybe if you tie your shoes, you know, maybe tomorrow, try tying your shoes with the lace, you know, in the opposite order, and you'll quickly get bollocksed up and go, oh God, this is really hard. I don't know how to do it that way. So to notice that there may be certain associations that we have adopted and carried for many years, and we've never stopped to examine. So at Harvard University, there's a group that, there's actually a website that you can go to that explores implicit bias. And it's an interesting thing, because the person that came up with it, with this test, this implicit bias test, he started to just do a thing of associations of flowers and insects, because, you know, most people like flowers and most people don't like insects. And so he would have people associate a certain word with a flower, associate a certain word with an insect, and see the preference for, oh, you know, associating maybe insects with words like disgusting versus words like, oh, beautiful with flower. And so when there's a conditioned association, you make the connection quickly. And when there's not, you make the association slower, just like trying to get your hands together the other way, it might have taken you a little bit of a moment to go, oh, I have to do it this way instead of, this way is fast, and this way takes a little thought. Oh, how do I do that? So that's how he came up with this test, was he started to make these associations and recognize that, wow, this actually does pull up these associations and shows them very clearly. And so he came up with these different tests, and you can take them. There's tests about how we associate names with certain values. So some of you may know that, for example, if you submitted a resume and you had a name that was Hispanic or Black, the person reading the resume may have an implicit bias that might not show up, but if they took the same resume and put a different name on it that was an Anglo name, that resume might get chosen, but nothing on it changed other than just the name. So it's interesting to see how powerful that bias is. There was a study that was done in the 50s around discrimination of musicians. I think it was the Boston Symphony. But people would come into audition, and more men were getting picked for the symphony than women. So they thought, there might be a bias. So they thought, let's put up some screens. So some screens like over there. And they had the musician on the other side of the screen, and they'd audition, and they were still getting more men than women. Until somebody thought about it, because the audition stage was a hardwood floor. And the women typically wore high heels. And somebody thought, take the heels off and make them come in feet with socks on. And sure enough, the bias of hiring more men went away when they did those auditions in that way. So that's how powerful this implicit bias can be. And so it's not that there's anything wrong with implicit bias, it's just that we have certain associated things that we associate together, and they form a particular bias. But our awareness of them is the piece that I want to highlight. The awareness of what is it that we are blind to, what is it that we're not aware of in our experience that might be a view that we're holding that might not be helpful or might not be skillful. So, you know, the easy ones are seeing the views that we hold on to and cling to in very tight ways that are obvious. But some of the views that we hold that aren't so obvious are ones to maybe also examine. The obvious ones that we can see are things like, how we might identify with a group. And it could be as simple as a football team. So for those of you who are 49er fans or Raiders fans, you'll know how much angst there is when your team wins or loses, or how heated people can be about their team. And yet, that's not very consequential, right? But we treat that very, very important. And in some cases, it's a life or death thing. A number of years ago, was it Rodney King that got beaten at one of the baseball? Or was it football?
Actually, Rodney King was in it. It was a different circumstance.
Yeah. But there was a baseball fan that got beat up.
Seriously beat up.
All over just an association with an identification with a particular group. So how do we make those associations? You know, how do we look at those associations? What happens when we don't pay attention to how we cling to an identification with a group or an idea? So in the Atakavaga, this is a verse that I came across one day, and it was one of those verses where you kind of think, oh, it's one of those fake Buddha quotes. Have you ever been to the fake Buddha quote site?
No worry.
So I'm going to read this to you, but the first time that I heard this, I thought, really? Did the Buddha say this? For one free of passion towards perceptions, there are no ties. For one released through wisdom, there are no illusions. For those attached to perception and views, roam the world offending people. Now the verse that I saw was something like, those attached to perception and views roam the world annoying people. And that was just like, yes. And I was like, did the Buddha really say that? And so this is the actual verse. This is one of the translations. So this is a translation by Bhikkhu Virado. Those attached to perception and views roam the world offending people. I bet we've all known somebody who was attached to a particular view, and they went around offending you. You know, you might have felt offended by them or annoyed by them. But how often do we go around with our own views, and maybe we offend people or annoy people because we're holding tightly to a particular idea or view? And it's hard. It's tough. I think there's a tendency in our current world view that there's a lot of polarity. There's a lot of polarization. It's like either you're for or you're against. You know, and there's not an in-between. There's not a place of just meeting different views. But there's this idea that one view has to be better than the other. And so I think this is a place where our practice can actually be of benefit. And our practice can help us to perhaps shift that culture out of this polarization to a different way of relating to different views. You know, one of the things that recently I saw was that we have somehow gotten away from being able to be with people of different views without having to, you know, argue for our point. You know, what is it like to hear someone else's view without having to convince them of our own? And what might happen if we didn't? What might change? There was an article that I read recently about a group that is called One America. It's an initiative put together by an organization called the Institute of American Values. And they brought together two different groups of people over a weekend. They brought together 15 residents of an area in Ohio, seven of which were conservative-leaning and pro-Trump, and eight were liberal-leaning and anti-Trump. And at the end of the week-long workshop, they issued a joint statement. We found that we are less different from one another and less hostile to one another than the pundits in the media typically say we are. A number of us on both sides began our meeting believing that the other side could not be dealt with on the basis of rational thought. We say unanimously that our experience of talking with, rather than at or about, each other caused us to abandon that belief. We say unanimously that real people are more complicated and appealing than the stereotypes we have of them. In this meeting, we did not change our views on issues, but we did change our views of each other. And surely in this time of extreme public rancor and mistrust, this change is a good thing for us and for the land we all love. So one of the things is to talk with each other rather than talking at or about one another. There's a quote by Barbara Deming: the longer we listen to one another with real attention, the more commonality we will find in all our lives. That is, if we are careful to exchange with one another life stories and not simply opinions. And so is there a way that we can use our mindfulness practice to separate opinion out in a way that we're aware of the opinions that we hold, so that instead of arguing for our opinion, we might open a conversation of the stories of our lives, where we might find a lot of commonality. You know, and as we sit in our own practice, as I sit in my own practice, you know, over the years, the practice of knowing ourselves actually helps us to know each other. Because we sit with these crazy minds that want to run around and think about and argue and judge and criticize and complain. And we learn a lot about hate and anger and frustration, irritation. We also learn a lot about love and compassion and kindness. We learn a lot about grief and sadness, of feeling alone, as well as feeling like we belong. And these are all common to each and every one of us. So the more that you begin to sit with your inner space, the more you begin to see what is in the outer space. And you start to see how difficult it is to be a human being. And in that moment, you have an opportunity to drop a view about someone else, to open to the possibility of hearing someone else in a different way, rather than identifying with how they look or how they talk or what color their skin is or how big or small or tall or thin they are, or what team that they're for or against, or what politician they're for or against. That if we could just reach at a human level, we have the opportunity of letting those views go. To connect with one another from a heart space, rather than up here, which tends to get us into a lot of trouble. So here's a quote from Mark Nepo. To listen is to continually give up all expectation and to give our attention completely and freshly to what is before us. Not really knowing what we will hear or what that will mean. In the practice of our days, to listen is to lean in softly with a willingness to be changed by what we hear. Some of you who have done day-longs here or elsewhere probably at one time or another in your practice has done some kind of listening exercise, right? And one of the challenges with really learning how to listen is how to get out of your own head, to watch your own mind as you're listening to someone and see when the mind starts to tune someone out or get caught in a memory or some thought that you're having, or even planning what you're going to say rather than hearing the other person speaking. And it's quite humbling to recognize sometimes how little we actually hear one another, how little we actually are present to hear and see the other person. And so when we can do that well, the whole idea of self goes away. Our agenda goes away. And it's just being present for that other person to hear, to witness, to really understand. And there's something very magical about that experience. And for the speaker, there's something quite beautiful that they can get from that, and that is to be heard. And I think all of us have a longing and a desire to be really heard, to be recognized, to be seen. And this is even true for all of the things that percolate in our inner world when we're sitting in meditation. There's the anger that wants to be heard. There's the sadness that wants to be heard. There's the complaining self that wants to be heard. And all we need to do is listen. We don't have to act it out, but we can give it audience. We can allow us ourselves to get the information from those messengers. So anger arises because there's some information that's needing to be transmitted to you, whether it's that maybe something has been violated, or maybe you don't feel safe, or maybe you somehow feel hurt, And so if we open to those kinds of messages, it's not that we need to get riled up by them, but we can receive them and hear them and then honor them in a way that doesn't cause harm. We can honor the message that says, I feel hurt. I can honor the message that says, I feel unsafe. I can honor the message that says, my boundary feels like it's been violated. But now I can act out of a place that's not caught in that anger, but out of a place that's authentic, that says, oh, I hear the message, and now I can respond. And I think that's what all of us dearly want, is to be heard and responded to in a way that validates us. So there's one last piece that I want to share, and this was out of a Parabola article interview with Karen Armstrong in 2016. I think it's relevant for today. So Parabola magazine said to Karen, "We're in a frightening place in world history. Your predictions about religious war have come true, and our whole environment is in a perilous shape. From your study of the origin of the great religious traditions, what really matters?" Karen answered, "The exercise of compassion is what matters in our world. The Dalai Lama says, 'My religion is kindness.' Confucius said, 'Religion is altruism.' Dethroning yourself from the center of your world and putting another there." Now that requires intelligent thought. You really have to think and practice the golden rule about what the other person really wants rather than what you think they ought to want. When we speak to people, we should behave as the Buddha or as Socrates did. Address them where they really are and not where we think they should be. We have to put ourselves in the place of another, and we have to be able to do this globally." And that's a difficult work because that asks us to put our views down. It asks us to put aside our agenda, or even our assumptions about people, to meet them where they are. So I hope this inspires you to perhaps step out of a little bit of that comfort zone, a little bit out of that bubble, to maybe be courageous, to see if there's a way that you can hold difference, not by having an either-or situation of, I have to get rid of this other view because it doesn't match mine, but a way that we could meet that and hold both, to recognize that perhaps in holding both, that there's a way of meeting one another. So, I'd like to open up if there's any questions. I could take a few questions or comments.
Kind of an observation. There's a reason that they're called fixed views. that I think are fact. And I don't necessarily categorize those as opinions. They're facts, so, that's cool.
Yeah.
There's a challenge right there, and even challenging our, what we view to be the truth, that are fact.
Right, right. So it's even to look at what we think are facts, or that we assume to be facts, and may not be a fact at all. You know, and to put that into perspective, you know, there was a time in which there were people on this earth that believed that the sun rotated around the earth. And that was considered to be a fact. And who knows, you know, we might find something else that's just as, you know, profound about our assumption that, you know, the earth is rotating around the sun. You know, in fact, for example, we think that the sun is stationary and the earth is rotating around it, but the sun is also moving, so the earth isn't actually moving around the sun, it's kind of spiraling and traveling through space, you know. So what do we take as fact? And sometimes even the fact can be perhaps not what we think it is.
I guess I don't really know quite what I'm going to ask, but I think what you're talking about is very, very important, relevant to our time, profoundly, and it feels like a tall order because there's so much lying, and so what's true, what's real, what's even an opinion, because, you know, there is this difficulty I can say that this person is probably hurting and suffering. And that's really at the root of why they are carrying this opinion, this view, that is really almost unconscionable for me, or really problematic. Mm-hmm. And so so compassion is essential, but there's also absolute foolishness sometimes, or like, what is going on? Where do these ideas come from? And so that's what we're where we are, at least for me.
Yeah.
Because I want to be open and really be magnanimous in nature, because that's, we really want to live our higher self, But you know, so it's you can't let yourself get discouraged.
Right.
You really can't. Otherwise, finish.
Yeah.
So you have this Buddha nature, this nature that, you know, we're is a big part of our practice to be connected with. It's in everyone. We believe that. But it's, yeah, so how do we,
Yeah. So, you know, one of the questions that I continually hold, maybe it's like a koan, is, you know, how do I know what delusion is? How can I know delusion? And even, how can I even communicate with someone who might be deluded, right? And one of the things that I've learned over time is that, first of all, trying to convince someone who cannot see that is actually not very productive, right? And so what is necessary, right? And this is perhaps really important, is to see, for example, even in your own practice, when you resist something in a way that's confrontational, what results, right? And what happens if you don't hold that so tightly? What changes, right? And so if for example, Nathaniel, I'm going to ask you to do a little example for me. Just stand up and sure. Push against my hand. So if we're pushing against each other like this, we're not going to get very far. And not only that, but it takes me a lot of energy. It probably takes Nathaniel a lot of energy to hold that, right? But if I change that and I let go, what happens? He actually has to do something in response. And one of the things that we can notice is the energy that it takes when we're resisting something and how much of our own distress comes up by the resisting. It doesn't mean that I let go and I just let something happen, but when my letting go allows something to shift, right? It changes that dynamic. And so sometimes it's recognizing that instead of constantly trying to force something to happen, that if I allow and let go, that it allows the dynamic to change, and maybe there's an opportunity in that dynamic for me to make a difference, right? And so, for example, if someone is very confrontational, I like to even bring in the image in my mind, you know, if there's an animal that's afraid of you or is somehow hostile to you, how do you actually make friends with it? You don't make friends with it by beating it, and you don't make friends with it by trying to corner it. But instead, you have to extend some kind of, create some kind of trust or some kind of connection that allows that animal to feel safe with you. And then something can happen. But as long as you're pushing against it or acting like you're about to do something to it, it's going to actually get worse. It'll actually get more inflated, more aggravated, right? And so what do we have to do? It may seem like it's contradictory, right? And there are times that you might have to say, stop, that's not okay, right? So there's wisdom that has to be blended with compassion. You know, we can't just have compassion that's not informed. We have to have compassion that is informed by wisdom. And so compassion can be very strong and fierce that says, no, that's not okay. But there's also the compassion that says, I see you, and I see perhaps the pain that you're in. And so if you're in pain, the right response to you is not to force you to feel more pain, but instead to address what the pain is that you're feeling, right? Now that's very simple, and it may not, you know, it's not that it's going to fix the world, but we can do little things, and I think that's the important thing, is that sometimes we have this illusion, I've got to fix the whole system, instead of what I can do is do small things in the sphere that I can affect, right? So in Modesto, for example, I've been involved in an interfaith clergy group of different faith leaders in the area, and one of the commitments that we've worked with is we come together once a month and we learn about each other with no agenda about trying to convince anybody of our faith, but to start to learn to meet each other as people, as individuals who struggle just like we do, who have similar problems just like we do, and we start to actually create friendships so that we are not afraid of one another, because fear comes when we do not understand the other, and so we think, oh, I need to be safe, so I put up a wall and separate from that group. The only way that we can work together is to take those divisions down and connect. It's hard work and it takes time, and I think this is the other piece. So most of us want the answer today, and you know, this is work that has to happen not overnight, but gradually. Not a easy, simple solution. And so seeing the whole picture is important. You know, so for some of us who might have been in a bubble until the election, and then suddenly that bubble burst and we go, oh my God, I didn't see that all of this other stuff was there. So part of it is to recognize and see what is here, just like in our practice. What is here? And yeah, maybe you don't like what's shown up, but our practice is to meet it, to see it clearly first. You can't change it unless you see it. So we have to see all the suffering on all sides. That's the only way that we can meet that. So thank you for your attention and your practice. You know, the amount of practice that we do together, sometimes it may seem inconsequential, but every little bit that in some way helps you to be less rigid, less fixed in your views, starts to shape that world, starts to make those changes. And we have to see the larger picture, a larger view, but every little drop makes a difference. Every little drop will eventually fill the jar. We just keep doing our practice. Keep working on ourselves. You know, peace will not come by us saying everybody else has to be peaceful, but not me. I have to do my work too. So I thank you for all the work that you do here.